Hello and welcome. I am Susie, and this is my podcast. I'm so happy you're here, and I'm excited to talk to you some more about the noisy thoughts in my head about justice. Help me get them out and make them quiet, will you please? In the previous two parts, I outlined some really broad concept about justice in America, how it was shaped by the history of the world, and how it has manifested itself back into the world, as well as a lot of piping hot tea on J. Edgar Hoover, and how his kooky mind formed the entire country's understanding of law enforcement. In this part, I want to talk about modern justice. The world looks a lot different right now, and there have been a lot of different equity movements that have taken hold, and we're finally beginning to see a world in which people are slightly less defined by their aesthetic characteristics. In the U.S., the ideals of freedom that define our country have undergone significant redefinitions through pivotal movements of history, and I think our modern-day systems do better reflect aspirational democratic values. But there's a long road ahead of us, and that work is not done. I have a lot of thoughts about how we've progressed and how much more there is yet to do. I want to talk about it, and I hope you'll hang out with me and listen. That's why you're here, right? Has been discussed on this podcast ad nauseum, the paradox of American ideals of freedom existing alongside oppressive means of governance perplexes me no end. We seem to want to constantly gravitate back to that state of hypocrisy, always. The chief paradox and the thing that haunts us the most, of course, is the legacy of slavery. Now, I'm not necessarily qualified to give anyone a history course on slavery, and I don't need to. Nicole Hannah Jones has done it already in the 1619 Project. Please go read it. The really big takeaway here is that slavery was an institution that shaped America, and we have never dealt with it fully. We are still grappling with it today. When I think about slavery in America, my first thoughts form around the fulcrum point when the 13th Amendment was passed in 1865, abolishing slavery from the U.S. and freeing hundreds of thousands of Black Americans on paper. They were granted freedom, but no justice. They were no longer in bondage, but every aspect of their circumstances disadvantaged their ability to support themselves with any sort of human dignity. And popular culture did everything possible to impede any progress that was made. For instance, in slavery, slaves were not permitted to learn to read or write. But woof wham, slavery is over. But now, if you want to vote, you've got to pass a literacy test. No one had to do so before slavery was abolished. It was a direct action to prevent Black people from voting and therefore from exercising their rights endowed by the Constitution and subsequently shift the power base. The freedom endowed in the Constitution wasn't applied without limit throughout the Union. And limited freedom is really no freedom at all, is it? It's freedom with a footnote. You acquired your release from slavery through battle in a brutal civil war. Then that apparent freedom is slowly eviscerated until it's only a shadow of what it is supposed to be. 100 years of segregation, lynching, oppressive laws, and a culture of vengeance. Though the defining document of our country declares that shall not be. Then, another series of battles, one without fighting, through nonviolent civil disobedience, which resulted in vicious and violent retribution, culminating in historic legislative progress. But, as they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make her drink. And there remain plenty of horses who would rather die of thirst than drink from a font of justice. And so the fight continues. And that fight takes a toll. The cultural impact of racism has an actual psychological effect. The psychic damage done from the effects of oppression are considerable. And the degree to which resistance to oppressive systems must sustain a counterforce against a power base at full steam, like getting a freight train at full speed to stop suddenly, is toil. It's hard, nasty, dangerous work that for most people doesn't deliver any reward in your lifetime. The progress is slow and incremental, and it only comes when society is forced to face a naked truth that they would otherwise choose to ignore. But the repressed won't be silent. There will always be an uprising of one sort or another. There will always be a paradigm shift. But can there be justice? I feel like the answer there is not satisfying, namely that it's by degrees. And once again, we see images of a horrific police murder of an unarmed Black man, Tyre Nichols, in Memphis, Tennessee. One thing that's different in this case is that the officers who killed him, there were at least five of them, were all Black. Another is that they were fired. And another is that they were pretty promptly charged with second-degree murder. And I can't help but wonder if the latter two things have something to do with the former somewhat. I dunno. That may be an overreach. But there's certainty in the brutality of their act and the police culture that led them to that moment, even as we consider the many distinctive characteristics of the incident itself. It's still cops brutalizing and killing Black people as a norm. And where is the justice for that? In 1946, a Black American World War II vet, Isaac Woodard, was returning home from war, on a bus traveling home through the South with a bunch of vets. Sergeant Woodard approached the bus driver and asked if they could stop at the next town for a restroom break. The bus driver told him to shut up and sit down and treated him the way Black people were treated in the South in 1946. But Sergeant Woodard had just returned from war. He served proudly in the Army, and Sergeant Woodard felt that he had earned his dignity, and he said so to the bus driver. He was courteous but firm, as the Army had trained him to be, and he said that he didn't appreciate being addressed in such a manner. He pointed to his uniform and decorations and reminded the bus driver of his sacrifice for freedom in the world and in America. The bus driver stopped the bus at the next town and got off. He came back in a few minutes with the local police, Chief of Police Shull, and a couple of officers. They dragged him off the bus and beat him mercilessly. Shull bashed the end of his billy club into his eye sockets, blinding him. They left him for dead, and the bus driver got back on the bus and drove away. Isaac Woodard managed to get medical attention, and he survived the savage attack. The leaders of the NAACP heard about what happened, and they took up the cause to help him and to shed some light onto his case, because even a veteran who fought in a war against tyranny was subject to repression and abuse in his own country if he was Black. He had to fight to get any veterans' benefits, and there were no legal consequences for the police officers who loudly and proudly bragged about what they did to Isaac Woodard, who had the nerve to wear a uniform. There were no consequences at all for that act, in fact, until President Truman was shown photos of Sergeant Woodard's wounds and heard the story. At that point, and only because Woodard was a veteran, he insisted that the Justice Department take action and prosecute the officers. But the near lynching of Isaac Woodard was but one case, and he lived. Lynchings were common practice, and communities knew who committed them, but there were seldom legal consequences. In fact, there hasn't been a law against lynching since, like, the last couple of years. Meh. Isaac Woodard's case also was the spark that catalyzed the civil rights movement into its next push towards equality. The case was a big piece of bringing the issue of segregation to people's attention in a way that they truly began to understand how insidious it was. It led to the Brown v. Board of Education case in the Supreme Court, which then sparked a chain reaction leading to the major periods of demonstration and struggle, culminating in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the Fair Housing Act of 1968. Racial justice is like an entire podcast of its own, and I'm not qualified to do such a podcast, I do not believe. But within the broader context of justice, it's a very clear example where no justice is delivered. Here's another curious feature where justice is difficult to define. The distinction between violent crime and financial crimes. Broadly, we act like financial crimes aren't violent, but they are in the sense that they victimize people and deplete their economic resources that they need to survive. You know, ask any of the people at the hands of Bernie Madoff schemes if they feel like they were violated. You know, they do very much. And that's not necessarily an example where justice wasn't necessarily achieved because, you know, he went to jail, I guess, but no one got their money back. Like, again, where's the justice in, you know, locking up an old man? Anyway, moreover, looking at Russia's illegal war in Ukraine, you see a very clear example of plutocratic wealth establishing government authority, abusing international finance systems, taking money out of the pockets of their own people to support their own financial gain. These are all crimes. Putin's illegal war is killing thousands and damaging infrastructure in Ukraine and energy resources for most of Europe. Right now, teams of reporters and human rights advocates are documenting the copious war crimes against humanity being perpetrated in Ukraine. It'll be interesting what the international community does to prosecute those crimes. I think efforts will be made if, and it's a big if Ukraine is able to prevail in the war and keep all of their sovereign territory, and maybe even reclaim the annexed territory of Crimea. It's an interesting moment, and it really could break either way, in my opinion. For now, nearly a year, the Ukrainians have made clear that they have no intention of backing down, and the EU, NATO, and the US are all appropriately afraid of Vladimir Putin's potential actions. But the US's support is waning internally. Every time I hear people like Jim Jordan or Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz talking about how we shouldn't be supporting Ukraine economically, all I really can hear is echoes of the America First Committee in the 30s and the 40s. I hear Charles Lindbergh and Father Coughlin crying out that Roosevelt and the liberal elites led America to peril and encouraging the US to stay out of Hitler's way. There are eerie similarities to the sympathetic tone that a lot of Republican leaders have when speaking about Putin. I think we should take note of that. There are a lot of similarities to what Russia is doing now and what Germany was doing in the 1930s. Annexation of Crimea in 2014, with no international consequences whatsoever, reflects Hitler's annexation of Austria in 1938 and the Sudetenland in 1939, which was in part of what was then Czechoslovakia. The subsequent invasion of Ukraine looks very much like Hitler's invasion of Poland, with one important distinction. The Russian army was unable to defeat the Ukrainians. They've been fighting back hard, and Europe and the US have, for the most part, had their backs. If that changes, the international situation will very likely change in quite dramatic ways. The lack of international action in upholding some standards of justice has proven to lead to globally destabilizing consequences, never mind the terrific loss of human life that occurs under the wheel of that process. The problem with parsing justice to the point that it loses its meaning is that real death is a consequence. If you continuously attempt to pick apart the justifications for seeking justice, if you insist that a wronged party constantly have to prove and defend their injuries, then there's going to be a backlash. A kind of bizarro world example of this is the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The people who went to the rally and then proceeded to the Capitol and beat cops, broke into federal property, and disrupted a constitutionally sanctioned process of power transfer. They did this because they were fighting injustice, in their view. They believed their candidate had won an election, but he hadn't. He lied and lied and lied about it, And people believed that lie so hard that they thought the only way to make it right was to show up at the government and fuck some shit right up. They were encouraged to think that by a group of people who were in fact in that government at the time. They were organized and directed. They were instructed on how to promote the event and how to direct various parties at different places throughout the city. People involved in the planning worked in the White House and in Congress. In the end, four people were dead, some of them cops. No arrests were made on the day of the incident. In the weeks that followed the attack, nearly 400 people who were there at the Capitol were arrested and arraigned, and we're witnessing outcomes of court trials now, including verdicts of seditious conspiracy for members of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. Seditious conspiracy is an extremely difficult case to make, but they succeeded in like half a dozen convictions, which says a lot about the amount of evidence that was present. But we have not seen any accountability for the planning, the coordination, nor the promotion, recruiting, and just general support of the political leadership of that mob of people. And then who lied about it afterwards by downplaying its significance or its scope. They actively tried to murder the vice president and the speaker of the House of Representatives. And like, it's that dichotomy of American stupidity that makes us go, but they made it out. Like, what's the big deal? Well, they only made it out by a narrow margin, first of all. What if they hadn't? What do you think would have happened to them if a huge crowd of angry, armed people who were out for blood and had just beat the crap out of a bunch of armored police officers got their hands on them? They constructed a working gallows right outside the Capitol building. They brought wood and tools, everything pre-measured and ready for installation. Why? That's a lot for a symbolic gesture. Where is the justice for the trauma our nation experienced, is still experiencing as a result of the incident? Where is the justice in pushing a bunch of angry white people through the meat grinder of the justice system, which has been slowly destroying communities of color for generations? It seems only to fortify and deepen their feelings of resentment. There's no spiritual awakening that will come from that process. Our criminal justice system is dehumanizing, partly because it was built for Black people, whom we have not thought of as human for most of our history. That's the truth as I see it. It's bleak. Our answer up to this point seems to have been doubling down as we continue to privatize prison systems. And I'll talk about prison reform and restorative justice in a future podcast, but for the sake of this argument, I will say that there are a number of pathways to thinking differently about justice. There are a lot of very smart people who have written and spoken a lot about how we can and should do things differently to really aspire to justice. The idea of restorative justice is a promising area of thought in my view. The idea centers on viewing justice as addressing the harm caused by the crime rather than purely on the punitive framework. Locking someone up or killing them as vengeance doesn't really have a restorative effect in helping a victim cope with the trauma. It is a process, and it does require that we view both parties in the circumstances as free human beings, and within the context of ensuring that individuals and communities are healed from trauma rather than simply adding new trauma on top. You know, and if you feel like that's soft, you know, imagine how hard it is for you to confront someone that you've wronged in a small way. You know, imagine the guilt and the shame and maybe even the fear that you feel associated with that act. And now multiply that by, you know, many, many factors. That's awful. That pain is awful. And people need to feel their pain and process it to confront their actions and make amends for them. There is almost nothing about the prison system that allows for that to occur. And that isn't mutually exclusive with some other form of you know, punitive act, right? Like, it doesn't mean you run around free in a field of daisies. It means that you commit to healing the harm of the crime that you committed and, you know, committing to the accountability for that and rectitude of some kind. And that seems fair. It feels a little more like justice. As always, I don't pretend to have the answers to all these enormous and complicated questions about justice. My heart and my mind both agree that we can and should do better as Americans to aspire for real justice, not just Hoover's idea of law and order. There are an enormous number of people out there who are thinking powerfully about solutions to these problems that are inclusive and noble and are truly a better reflection of what we have claimed America to be for centuries and have yet failed to achieve. Kimberly Crenshaw, Nicole Hannah-Jones, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Olufemi Otaiwo. I couldn't possibly name them all, but I've referenced many of their ideas, and I'll leave a reading list in the description of this pod and on my Instagram if anybody wants to dive into a rich and refreshing pool of pristine philosophical and human insight that's practical and achievable. That's the conclusion of this series of episodes on justice. I have answered no burning questions. That is not my way. But I hope to have inspired you to think about the possibilities. Paradigmatic or disruptive change is scary. Heck, normal workaday change is scary for a lot of people. But change that makes life better for everyone is change worth seeking. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you'll come back. If you enjoyed it, tell someone you like. Give them the gift of my goofy verbal circus tent with all of the requisite fun sideshows and attractions everyone enjoys. If you'd like to contact me for feedback or suggestions, I hope you'll feel free to do so. I have an email address at suzimakespodcast@gmail.com. And I have an Instagram of the same name, suzimakespodcast. Come and find me. Until next time.